You are now listening to the Experience Magazine podcast in association with CEIA. Thank you for listening. This podcast is only made possible by listeners like you. We appreciate you, and we hope that you continue to experience with us. On today's episode, we have Aaron Bradley. Aaron Bradley is an associate professor and faculty lead of the Next Innovation Scholars Program, a signature cross-disciplinary innovation initiative at the University of Cincinnati. He teaches courses on design thinking, innovation, and digital storytelling, and regularly leads a variety of industry-sponsored design sprints and ideation sessions with students from multiple colleges, academic years, and areas of study. His expertise in with experiential learning and the development of university/industry partnerships has led to the creation of multiple new courses and programs, including the development of the nation's first and only cooperative education program for fine arts students, and the creation of the Virtual Innovation Studio. The Virtual Innovation Studio, a cross-disciplinary student consultancy that completes innovation and design research projects for industry clients while working 100% remotely. Professor Bradley's research and scholarly expertise includes the future of work, the future of education, and the evolving role of creativity as a professional skill. There will also be a special guest appearance. We hope you enjoy the episode.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Experience Magazine podcast. I'm Eric Allenson, Director of Computing and IT Co-op Programs at the University of Cincinnati. I am joined, as always, alongside my co-host, the apprentice of articulation, Dr. Michael Sharp. How are you, Mike?
Eric, I'm doing well. I'm very much enjoying every episode. You have a new moniker for me. What was this one today? The apprentice of what?
Articulation.
Apprentice. Okay. All right.
Yeah, you've been improving, Mike.
Oh, thank you.
Since our earlier days, pre-teaching communication rhetoric,
right,
and having little to no experience in the podcasting and broadcasting space, I have to tip my hat to you, my friend. You are doing much better.
Well, when I get to rub elbows with super talented people like you, Eric, it's bound to wear off at some point, right?
That's right. What do they call that? Osmosis or something? Virtual osmosis. You're taking it in just by merely interacting with me through StreamYard.
Yeah. Well, Eric, I'm excited for today because we've talked about doing this for quite some time and we're going to try it out, which meaning we have two guests on today's show and we strategically chose two people that we work with. So if we screw this up, we won't be too embarrassed. And so I'm really delighted to introduce to the show today. We have Professor Frank Russell and Professor Aaron Bradley. Gentlemen, how are you doing today?
Great. Happy to be with you.
Yeah, doing well, man. really appreciate knowing that I'm on with an apprentice. That's right. Excites me quite a bit. So thanks for having me.
We'll every time I embarrass you.
Every time I think of that word apprentice, I think of that show that was created by our former president. I can't shake that image. So I hope, Eric, that's not what you had in mind when you came up with today's nickname for me.
No, absolutely not, Mike. Not oriented towards that show at all. Just
he's
just,
building up to a big. Building up to a big you're fired, right?
Yeah. Hopefully not. Considering this is a volunteer gig for us, I think I'd be pretty embarrassed if we were let go. But you never know, Aaron. You never know.
You never know for sure. So, Frank, if it's okay, I'd like to start with you. I know that you've been around the university for quite some time. You predate my hire in 2008. So can you tell us a little bit about you and your role at the University of Cincinnati?
Oh, I was here when you were just little pups many, many years ago, even before the word Next Lives Here was coined, and the previous four UC strategic plans as well. I think I've been through four presidents and five provosts and learned nothing from any of it. I'm getting the most bang from my buck just hanging around with you guys more recently. But my home college was DAP, the College of Design, Architecture, Art, and Planning. An architect by training and taught for many years over there in the subject of urban design, and then started this program called UC Niehoff Urban Studio, which was bringing together different disciplines to work on problems of the city, and started that in 2001. So it's been 20 years, and it still exists, although in a different form. So that's where I come from, and now I'm running more recently, since 2017, a program called UC Forward, which is promoting a pedagogy of engagement across disciplines, which is rare at the university, and importantly, connecting with external partners in a way that address these challenges that they might bring to us, so that we can use the talents of our faculty and students to solve some of these wicked problems, as we call them, in the outside world.
Frank, can you expand a little bit on UC Forward for our listeners? It is such a really cool, innovative program that you run, and I know you've had some amazing industrial as well as not-for-profit partners over the years. Would you be able to highlight maybe a couple of those engagement opportunities and the maybe some of the recent UC Forward projects you've had?
Happy to. So I want to give credit where credit is due, so I don't get fired, which is with our dean and leader, Gigi Esco, Associate Provost, Vice Provost. It was her brainchild to model a program which would bring together different disciplines, as I've described, which didn't exist before. And she was successful in gaining the attention of the president, who ended up funding made funds available to incentivize this kind of activity between faculty, which, as I said, is very difficult because faculty got a lot of other things to do, and they don't get rewarded for helping other faculty out in other colleges as we would like them to do. So there's an incentive program which she was trying to create to make these partnerships happen. And she, I think, initiated the program in 2011. Since then, every year, we've offered a native course in our division, ELSI, called Inquiry to Innovation, that is sort of a showcase of how to do this type of class. Aaron Bradley has taught a number of those. Probably our superstar, he's a superstar of Inquiry to Innovation, does them better than anybody else. But a number of faculty have taught these. In each iteration, we attempt to have a meaningful partnership collaboration with an outside partner. Many of those have been corporate partners. I'll work backwards. Some have been nonprofits. I'll work most recently, we've run one on Zero Hunger, Zero Waste with the Kroger Corporation. We work with the Standard Textile Corporation on very specific technical problems. We work with a nonprofit on urban wilderness. This would be about a leadership program. Going back to probably one of the earliest ones was with Future of Work. And that was co-sponsored by Duke and BHDP. And Aaron Bradley is going to talk a lot more about this, so I won't say a lot more about it, except that that was probably, the origin of the Future of Work theme in ELSI. And it was a productive partnership, I think, really driven by architect named Dominic Giacobucci and his architecture firm, but has since yielded all kinds of interesting spinoffs. And Aaron's going to talk about those, and I can come back later and talk about the riff on that, which is the Future of No Work initiative. So that's sort of some of what we've done over time with the program. there are other funding programs I won't talk about much because they stray a little bit from future work, but I'll leave it there.
Frank, that's fascinating. And I've been, you know, pretty intimate with UC Forward for quite some time. And I know that Aaron has really broken new ground in that space. And so, Aaron, can you tell us and our listeners a little bit about your leadership with this theme of the future of work?
Yeah, sure. No, I appreciate it. Yeah, as Frank mentioned, my first connection to it was through the Inquiry and Innovation class with Dominic Iacobucci and BHDP. And at the time, I don't think that we realized how much of a big deal the idea of future of work was going to become. So at the time, it was an interesting topic. And to be honest, like what actually makes me chuckle now is that the majority of the people that were interested in future work 7-8 years ago, when we were first starting to do this work with a class, were really just trying to figure out, it was companies that wanted to sponsor a class to figure out how to get millennials to either come work for them or stay working for them and not quit. And I mean, they were pretty brazen in just telling us, like, that's really what the goal is here. We want you to help us figure out how to get millennials to stay working for us because we have so much turnover. Probably one of the most interesting, fun things about teaching that class and working with Dominic and kind of using the model of having a partner who is involved in a class, but in a unique way, was that we kind of had to nuance, okay, that's what you're asking for, and that's what you're willing to sponsor, in fact, but we don't necessarily think you're asking the right question. We think you're simplifying this too much to make it about generations. And the research that we were doing even through the class was showing that this wasn't really about generations. The future of work was not just about, like, how do we get millennials to stay working at a big company? There's societal macro trends that play in that affect, you know, whatever your age range is, but there's also things that affect you that, you know, just have to come, you know, kind of have to do with like when you came of age. You could be a non-traditional student who kind of was experiencing things at the same time that someone who's 10 or 15 years younger than you were. And that could affect your approach to what work looked like and what you wanted work to be. So we spent a couple of semesters just really kind of trying to like help people reframe what they were asking us to look at. And so what was kind of fun after that too was sort of tongue in cheek. I would get asked to come speak at different corporate events or like be a consultant on small projects for companies and things like that. And they all wanted me to come in and talk to them about, hey, we heard you can help us figure out how to get millennials to stay working for us. So I would take the gig knowing like, okay, that's what you think you want to talk about or whatever. And then spend the first like 30 seconds of the presentation showing them why this is not about millennials. And I just would show them like, here, we'll do it in real time. I'll Google millennials in the workplace and you'll see that in less than a second, there's this many million responses of things you can look up and show you what that is. What I want to talk to you today is actually about how societal macro trends and things that are going on in the world around us are affecting the future of work and how maybe as companies, you want to start looking further ahead to those kinds of things, right? And so it was fun because the way that I kind of started describing it to people was that talking about generations in the workforce is kind of like talking about the actual waves that are crashing, you know, when you're standing at the beach. Talking about societal macro trends is talking about all of the things that affect what causes tides and cause breaks in the ocean to then turn into waves and things like that, you know? So that kind of helped frame it for people. And over time, what's happened is the world has changed and gotten so much more complicated and complex that I think there's a lot more openness now to a company saying, or an external partner saying, yeah, don't just tell me about how to get millennials or now Gen Z to stay working for me. They just want to understand because the world has gotten so much more complicated and work has become so much more of a challenge loaded kind of heavy thing that involves all parts of society and all parts of people's lives, that we can't just make it now about how do we keep a certain generation working for us, you know?
Aaron, that's awesome. And I love the wave crashing analogy as well. Can you tell us a little bit about some of these societal macro trends? Because that's the first time I've heard that framed and it seems very sensible to me. But I'm wondering, through the work that you've done with these students, offering the Future of Work Studios now for some time, what are some of these trends that you're seeing evolve in the workspace?
Yeah, no, you know, pre-pandemic, obviously now there's this life event that we all have, like a before and after, you know, and work obviously is a huge part of that. There's been affected by the pandemic. But even pre-pandemic, there were things that were sort of inklings of things like, you know, kind of neo-tribalism, you know, how it was getting easier and easier to kind of like adapt to and only align with people that were most like you. And then kind of, in some ways, in a good way, maybe like find your kind of little niche of people that, you know, had these same unique interests that you had or saw the world the way you did. And that was really life-giving and helpful in some ways, you know, but then also we've seen some of the negative things that have come from that of creating echo chambers, things like that. Obviously the idea of, you know, remote work was even pre-pandemic was a thing that people were starting to talk about and kind of recognize like, well, the tools keep getting better and better. Like, do we really necessarily need to be as hung up on, you know, where we're located? AI was a popular topic that a lot of people were talking about. And, you know, Frank mentioned even running a forum on that. Students were more and more interested in that. And I think for different reasons than maybe people who were out in the workforce were. Students were interested in it because they saw it as a new platform, an opportunity to like, how is this going to affect the kinds of jobs I might do and like the ways I might leverage this technology that's becoming more and more available to do cool things. And then people out in the workforce saw AI and said, this is a threat that's going to take away all of our jobs. How are we going to react to that? Right. So that became an interesting thing to have students study and talk about in a class that was then presenting to professionals who were seeing it as a fear-based thing. And we had some really interesting projects where students actually kind of helped companies reframe that question of AI to say, like, well, what if it was no longer a threat and actually you saw it as just a new form of coworker? You know, things like that were kind of the macro trends that we tended to explore.
Interesting, Aaron. And I'm remembering back at the beginning of the episode today, Frank talked a little bit about the future of no work and even interacting with my own students and talking about AI and things like that. There is some fear, like what kind of career can I choose that's robot proof or that I'm going to be able to sustain over life? And so, Frank, can you talk a little bit about your concept of the future of no work?
Yeah, it's fun to talk about this, but also a little bit scary because we've got the one guy who's going to take away all of our jobs sitting with us, Eric Allenson, who works in IT. So here's the guy who's going to put us out of work altogether. So I have to be careful what I say here, but there is this tension about this notion of whether, you know, oh, let's refine what we've got. You know, the work continues as we know it into eternity. And then there's the counter narrative, which is that the bots are going to take over everything. We'll be left to our own devices. And so the notion of dealing with that scenario came out of the need to be sure that we were educating our students to address either one. And the notion that it's in many of the skills that we don't necessarily appreciate from a pre-professional point of view that these students may need to acquire their expertise. And those are the non-cognitive skills, you know, leadership, teamwork, things that relate to decision-making and describing what the problems are, the perception and interpretation and synthesis of what problems are for the bots to work on. So, the big concern there was like, okay, well, how do we restructure our pedagogy to make sure that we're inculcating those skills in our students through the education, through our curriculum? And so the future of no work was thinking mainly about that, but it was also thinking about what do we do when we have no work and it's okay? What do people do with their lives? How do they maintain fulfilling? Because, you know, the four of us, we say, you know, life is work. There is nothing else. So take that away from me. What am I going to be doing with myself? So we, strangely enough, we may need to educate students on what to do with themselves when they are not doing what we call work. But so that was a really interesting discussion. And I'm by no means an expert in this area. We are thrilled to bring in again, because of our wonderful leadership at the top of our division, GTSCO, bring in a scholar on the future work. She's managed to wrestle some more funding from the central administration based on Aaron's work, Corey Christopher, the previous future work director, previous UC4 director, around this issue of future work to actually fund a scholar who's going to come in and lead us to think more in depth about the issue, whether it is the one scenario, work as there changes, or the other scenario, future of no work. And that'll be very interesting and I think a real benefit to our division.
Guys, some awesome insights here we're gathering, and I know our listenership is going to want to dive deep into this and the comments you've provided. I wanted to ask, recognizing these two concepts, future of work, future of no work, we've talked a little bit about the implications for industry, but I'm wondering, for the vast majority of our listeners are experiential education, career education practitioners. What do you see as some of the implications around your work with the future of work concept, as well as the future of no work? What are the implications at the higher education practitioner level?
Yeah, well, I can share a little bit about that. I mean, some of this was stuff that I even looked into pretty deeply when preparing for the, you know, the talk that Frank was mentioning there before. We had this faculty forum and various faculty talked about this. I mean, one of the things that really struck me when doing some research for that was a McKinsey study from just a couple of years ago that's still very relevant. And at the time, they said automation would displace between 400 and 800 million jobs by the year 2030, which would also then cause as many as 375 million people to switch job categories entirely. That one really stuck out to me, because what you're talking about is, you know, with less than 10 years from now at this point, and then you think about an undergraduate who entered their, you know, undergraduate career in like 2019, 2020, something like that, that's still really relevant. They're early in their career. We're saying that by the time they graduate, they're graduating out into a system where 375 million people are going to have to completely switch job categories. And the key to that too is we're not just talking about switch a job, like, oh, I need to go from this company to this company. Literally switch entire categories, right? That really struck me, because a lot of university programs tend to kind of like train students to think in this very linear fashion of like, major in this thing because you want to get this job, because sometimes that choice is even made just because of how much it pays or because of a family member that did that job, or they think that it's an interesting field, right? So from an educational standpoint, I feel like there's a duty almost that we have to start structuring our programs and talking to students about the reality that a college education, at least at the undergraduate level, when you're, if you're coming to it through a traditional path, it can't be about, okay, do this because of the linear path you want to take to get to a certain job. We have to frame it for them as, this is a time when you are going to be taking in knowledge from multiple sources and learning how to think, not so much what to think, right? You can, I mean, knowledge is so accessible now through some Google searching or, you know, archiving things that, you know, looking up, finding the archive is something that you used to have to go on a quest to go find knowledge about, right? That it's so accessible that we can't just expect that the value proposition of a degree is now like, well, we'll tell you all this stuff that we happen to be the keepers of. We have to actually create experiences for them and invite them into things that shape the way that they think. And I think that happens through projects that are very timely and relevant, doing research that's maybe non-traditional means, like, you know, I'm big on doing design research and using design thinking with students. These are tool sets that kind of frame the way you approach problem solving, or the way you go about seeking knowledge, or the way you go about applying or adapting to what's happening in real time, versus looking at the educational institution as this place where, like, well, we keep all the knowledge in here and then you come get enough of it from us for 4 to 5 years that you'll be able to go do a job that, oh, guess what, might not exist by the time you graduate, whether it be because of automation or just other market disruptions, right? That's the thing that I think has really happened through the pandemic, is that the pandemic really just accelerated a path that we were on. I've told several people over the last year that I think that what's happened in the last year has really just been an accelerant of something that would have taken 20 to 30 years to happen in the past. We did it all in a year. It made us, it forced us look at some things differently about what the value of an education is, how and where you can work, how you collaborate with people, what's important about your personal life versus your work life, all of those things. So to me, we have a differing sort of place that we maybe fit into the larger ecosystem as an institution.
Aaron, that is a fascinating answer. And I'm curious, and Frank or Aaron, you could probably answer this. When you're interfacing with industry, do they also have a sense of the responsibility that higher education has to better prepare our students for this rapidly changing workforce and rapidly changing globe? Is your sense that they are anticipating more support from us?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's twofold, right? So on the one hand, they're very quick to be somewhat critical and just say like, well, we're not getting what we're looking for from graduates because they don't have these skills, right? But when we invite them in to say like, okay, well then how about if we together work on solving that? I've found at least there's quite a few people in industry that are really excited about the fact that A, just that we would give them that opportunity to say like, okay, be a part of the solution. And then B, that it gives them a chance to actually, see some of that talent development while they're younger. That's probably one of the most interesting things to me too, is that when we do these projects, there's an equal number of partners that want to be a part of a project because they feel like we can actually help them solve the problem. And when we do, it's really cool. Like, I love it when I have students who tell me, or a company that tells me like, yeah, those things that students came up with, those are going to market in 6 months. We did a project with some students back in the fall that legitimately their design work that they did is on the shelves right now because of things that we kind of adapted for them and gave them a pathway to accelerating some ideas for some sustainable packaging and some contests that they could do around it. So like, we solved a problem for them in that case. And they used students and their mindsets and their kind of naive innovation mindset to think about how to solve a problem uniquely, and it worked. But there's equal parts industry partners who want to come to us to say like, I'm happy to be a part of that, but I know that realistically, there's only so much we can do with working with an undergraduate course for a short amount of time, right? What I really want to do is I want to start understanding and developing a talent pipeline by meeting some of the students who are maybe in their second or third year of a 4 or 5 year degree and see how they think, so that we can figure out as a company too, what do we maybe need to even adapt in terms of our training or the policies or the mentorship and things like that that we create, because we realize it's unrealistic to have them come out and be completely ready to do every job that we also know may not exist, right?
I'll add to that.
Oh, go ahead, Frank.
I'll add to that there's another aspect to it, which is sort of interesting. And I know that Aaron's had an opportunity to do this, and I have as well. Those members of the different corporate partners we might be working with, or nonprofits partners, that they want some personal development as well. Believe it or not, you know, these individuals are getting, you know, some release time from their desk job to come in and participate with us as faculty and with the students in a way that they can't reproduce out there in their daily life. And so there's actually a developmental opportunity for them that they take advantage of. I will say that the other attraction that some corporate partners have is simply to have the affiliation to the university, because it gives them, maybe through us directly or through other connections, gives them ability to connect to an institution that can provide a lot of value to them in one way or the other. But I will say one last thing, which is Aaron's alluded to this, the naive innovation aspect. Those partners that I've found to benefit the most are the ones that are most willing to appreciate the naive innovation, not expect the professional product that they may get from a pre-professional program, a co-op or something like that, that want to sort of understand the question that they're asking and are willing to question the question and look at what and understand what they don't know and maybe shift the direction of their inquiry. Those that are open to that get to experience and appreciate the journey just like we do every time we begin a class, not knowing how we're going to end up.
Guys, I want to come back to this point on hiring because I thought it was a really important one. I'm hearing this theme from both of your perspectives in this space around hiring individuals for more of these human skills over technical skills. And something I've seen for years, and I've had to push back on it somewhat for the hiring practices of information technology students, is so many of our industrial partners want to hire based on skills that individuals possess at this time. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts around how do you change this paradigm to encouraging companies to hire for human skills that they can recognize in an interview or in a cover letter and a resume, perhaps, versus just hiring them from a skill or a bullet point they have on their resume? Because I very much would like to see that type of evolution. How can you go about maybe promoting that or engaging in that paradigm shift?
I'll throw out another model, which in probably our responsibility to disseminate this approach to partners and employers. And I think you do. I know that Professor Aronson has worked with placing co-ops. So you know what that's like. You've had direct connection to them. And the idea that we're trying to create, and that's unfair to talk about students as if we're creating them in some way. They're their own, their own voyagers in their journey. But they, we're trying to create this model or promote this model called the T student that is deep in one skill set, but broad enough in many of the other non-cognitive skill areas that give them the ability to be flexible, nimble, and respond to different situations in the workplace. Suppose they get moved from one position to another. You want someone that can respond to that quickly. That's outside their disciplinary skill set, but they acquire that. They're able to do that because they have some of these human-centered skills, as we like to call them.
Yeah, I mean, if I go to your question of, you know, how do we get them to do that? Man, that's tough. And I think it's probably not something that can be done small scale. It would require a major shift in the positioning of how companies saw universities as a resource to them in terms of talent development. And to some degree, you know, we have to be careful that we don't position work integrated learning as just, you know, hey, this is a great way for you to fill your pipeline, right, with talent. I mean, unfortunately, that's the thing, is like we're our own worst enemies sometimes in that, right? We know that that's a great way to get a foot in the door, to get students the experience that we know that they need in order to be effective. So we speak the language of industry and say, hey, look, they've got all these skills that you can immediately deploy, right? Like, isn't this great? You can hire a second year student who's already got all of these really relevant skills. But when we do that, sometimes I think we perpetuate the idea that we're just this talent mill that's turning out students that have the skill that you need right away today, which then, in fairness to a company that then looks at us and says like, oh, well, the world has changed at this pace, and now these are the skills that I need them to have at a technical level or whatever it may be. Why are you not teaching those? You know, last semester it was this, and this semester it should be this, right? So I think some of it is the burden we have on us as institutions of higher education is to help maybe, you know, educate, but then also through involving them. I don't want to make an us versus them situation, but say to our industry partners, like, hey, we all know that the world is changing faster than any of us can actually effectively react to unless we work together. So would you join us in creating the kinds of experiences that we know will be educationally sound? And as educators, we're going to own our part in this and saying, like, we'll help make sure that this is an effective educational experience and not just a talent mill, right? And then you, as an outside partner, can you help us understand how we need to adapt to make sure that they are at least keeping pace with the kinds of skills you're looking for? I do think that a lot of more companies are recognizing that, because even with retraining their own workers who have been out of school for 10, 20 years, it's not possible to expect that your graduates will always just have up to date, up to the minute, the skills you're looking for. So if we can just continue reminding them that, like, hey, we're here to be a partner with you in developing talent, which might mean, you know, helping you get access to and see students or interact with students who have the kind of mindset necessary to be a really great problem solver, have the adaptability that's going to be necessary to change as the world changes, having the resiliency to work through when things aren't easy. Would you be willing to give up some ground on saying, like, why aren't you teaching this specific programming language, you know, or whatever the tool may be, to instead have an opportunity to help influence and see the kinds of talent that has that more adaptable skill?
Guys, this discussion about the future of work and the future of no work is fascinating. I know that we could probably talk about this for 3 hours. But I know, because I have the pleasure to work with you both, that the future of work and the future of no work is just the tip of the iceberg of the vast amount of things that you both are doing. So for our listeners here, can you talk a little bit about the other really cool projects that you have that you're currently working on or projects that are coming down the pipeline?
Sure. So a couple of things. I mean, one of them that I feel like is, I hope, maybe an example of the kind of stuff that I'm talking about in terms of industry partnerships. For the last year, I actually haven't been teaching traditional classes. Normally, I would teach, you know, 3-credit-hour classes, and most of them would involve some kind of partnership and project like this. But in spring of last year, when the pandemic kind of immediately became something that we all had to respond to, and we realized the seriousness of it, we had obviously all of our students going remote. And then at the same time, we had students who, you know, summer is usually like the peak time for students having co-op and internship jobs. And it happened late enough in the semester that we had like 70 to 90%, depending on which major you were talking about, of our students already had accepted and been sort of, you know, locked into like, this is what I'm doing for my summer experiential learning program. Those were gone. I mean, it was like a stock market crash, like a sell-off, you know, like they were gone and out the door, where we went down to only having like 20% of our students in those situations, right? So I had been kicking around for years this idea of wanting to run almost like a little in-house kind of design thinking innovation studio or, you know, consultancy kind of thing with students. And there was some interest in it, but most of the time there wasn't enough of a need for it yet for anybody to really want to get over the hump of saying like, yeah, we'll put the effort into that, as opposed to maybe, you know, traditional co-op and internship and work integrated learning. All of a sudden we found a situation where like, well, I think we're going to need something. You know, we have all of these hundreds, actually literally thousands of students who are going to, on short notice, have to figure out what to do this summer to not sit the bench and get behind. And potentially, instead of not just breaking even, maybe we could get them ahead by giving them some of those exact skills we just talked about, like adaptability, resilience, showing that you can solve problems creatively. So I created a program called the Virtual Innovation Studio, where the vision for it was to take smallish groups of students, you know, maybe 25 or less at a time per project, to have them work intentionally in these cross-disciplinary groups to work with an industry partner on solving an actual real challenge or problem for them in a 5-week sprint kind of format. And so what we did was, by making these take the amount of time and hours that a co-op or internship would have taken, students were able to work on this in a completely virtual remote environment on a real project with an external partner, with a team of people that wasn't necessarily all like them and didn't think like them, and adapt to a ever-changing situation. You know, we were literally seeing the world kept changing by the minute in terms of like what the external, you know, what the market was doing, what external forces were doing, how long the projected runway to get back to quote unquote normal was going to be. It exemplified, if done correctly, all of the skills that we're talking about needing, right? And so over the course of the last year, ever since spring of last year, I've been kind of developing the pipeline of partners that want to do these kinds of projects with us, and then students that want to participate in them. And at this point, here we are at the end of the spring semester in 2021. So we've had 11 different partners do projects with us in this 5-week format, and more than 200 different students. And these are students from across design, technology majors, engineering majors, business. We've even had some arts and sciences students that kind of want to flex into this human space, but with more of a technical lens. And we've done things like develop apps. We've done things like change packaging. We've helped organizations transition their events from in-person to online events as a result of the pandemic. You know, it's all very, really timely stuff. And what's cool about it is that it's scalable out to where, like, we can keep doing this. If we don't have to have a remote version of it anymore, we could turn it into a hybrid version, or we could make it completely in person. And if we needed to scale back up because the world changes again, we can go remote again. And what I'm probably the side benefit that I didn't really anticipate coming from this is that this is likely, even if we don't have to from a pandemic, work remotely anymore, because we've seen now that it's possible to work remotely, and more companies are even looking at their policies and saying, like, do we need to bring everybody back together? For students to be able to now say that they've completed essentially a completely virtual work integrated learning experience, in some cases with more than one partner and project, and they've had to dive in, learn a project, learn a team, learn how to interact with a client and all of these things, present 100% virtually, collaborate 100% virtually, that's actually one of those skills that they probably are going to need to have when they graduate, right? And it came sort of, you know, through osmosis, use that word, we'll bring it back full circle from earlier of doing this thing that ideally we would have planned on it being in person, but we took advantage of the situation to actually teach them a skill that might be necessary, but was sort of ancillary to anything that has to do with their major. I talked for a long time. Frank, you should go.
Okay. I'll go. I'm supposed to be trying to make everybody else do what I want them to do. And I'm sort of supposed to be the Johnny Appleseed of sprinkling around the seeds of transformative experience-based learning throughout the university that involves multidisciplinary and cross-disciplinary work, that involves innovation, problem solving, that involves external collaborations. And so I've got a couple of programs going on, and one that I hope to move into reality. One is called the UC Forward CoLab program. UC Forward has some funding from the provost to stimulate cross-disciplinary work in the fashion we described. So traditionally I would hand out a grant program to faculty that wanted a course develop something in that area, with that approach. Typically I would all try to organize those around themes. Future of No Work, by the way, was one of them. And we had a course collaboration with three faculty on that theme. In the pandemic, much like Aaron, we're trying to respond to how we could put money into in the pockets of some of our own students who wouldn't have employment, who may have lost, who forget about pursuing professional training, who might have lost their job as, you know, in the service industry. So I reoriented or pivoted a little bit with that program, and again, theming it around urban resilience, opened a course development call for proposals, X thousands of dollars per two or three faculty collaborating. But the new aspect of that was that at least a half of this money needs to be spent on student wages, undergraduate student workers that would be engaged in co-curricular activities, not actually obviously teaching the course, and not doing graduate assistant type duties either, not making copies, but actually doing something that was developmental. And so this program, we've had we'll have our sixth faculty collab coming up this summer. And so in the process, they've actually employed a number of our students. So I felt that was the least I could do with trying to turn some of the university money into actual wages for students that could be integrated into, as a co-curricular activity, integrated into this larger UC Forward initiative. The initiative I'm working on now is to how to take some of these experiential learning opportunities that exist everywhere, much like Dr. Sharp and an experiential learning program. We have many courses, a couple thousand students that participate in transformational activity, more than 200 courses, I think, across the university. Of course, I don't teach all those courses. There are other people, but they're doing my stuff, which is transformational in terms of the pedagogy that we've described. What I'm aiming for now is how we can collect all the experiences that students have, much like Aaron's Virtual Innovation Studio, maybe Mike's service learning activities that occur with students, and somehow badge them or create a micro credential for those experiences that ladder up as students participate in any of the various activities. Maybe they're sprints with our 18-19 Innovation Hub. Maybe they're a faculty-led project over here, even a research project. But how do they ladder up to an academic credential that a student can acquire? Maybe it's a badge or a micro credential. VIS could be part of that, sprints. As I said, many other things that already exist at the university. So I'm trying to sort of, I don't need to be Johnny Appleseed in this category because the stuff is already planted and growing. I need to just harvest the fruit of those experiences and make it available for students in terms of academic credit so that they can, they don't have to feel that they're making an extra reach beyond what they're required to do with their degree and electives, of course, to have some of these experiences.
Guys, this has been absolutely fantastic. As Mike said, I know we could continue this conversation, but we do have to wrap. In terms of communication and outreach to you, you guys are really pushing the envelope and exploring some new spaces here around the future of work and the future of no work. Is there a way in which maybe some of our listeners can reach out to you if they have questions on any of these topics? And what would be the best way to do so?
Yeah, for me, shoot me an email, aaron.bradley@uc.edu, and let me know what you want to talk about. You know, I mean, I was a mentor for South by Southwest a couple of months ago, or like last month, I guess it was, where we had like a series of 15-minute conversations with people from all over the world that wanted to talk about this stuff. And, you know, if you come in with a good idea and you just want to bounce ideas around or like get some advice or something like that, we could have a great 15, 20-minute conversation. So feel free to shoot me an email.
You can get a hold of me or see my program by finding our website, which is UC Forward at the University of Cincinnati. So you can search that. You'll come up with our Collaborate and Innovate page.
Thanks, guys. We really appreciate your time and your expertise today. I know our listenership is going to be very interested in hearing this podcast, so we're looking forward to getting it up. Thanks to the listeners for tuning in to another episode of the Experience Magazine podcast brought to you by CEIA. For our guests, Aaron Bradley and Frank Russell, and my co-host, Michael Sharp, I'm Eric Allinson. We're looking forward to connecting with you again soon.